Hey, it's Motley Fool Money co-host Dylan Lewis here. If you're listening to us, it's because you love following the stock market and learning about business stories. If you're looking to keep learning and unlocking your potential, then you should check out the Think Fast, Talk Smart podcast produced by our friends over at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. Think Fast, Talk Smart is the Webby Award-winning best business podcast that's received nearly 43 million downloads and is the number one career podcast in 95-plus countries, so you know it's worth your time. Each week, host and Stanford lecturer Matt Abraham sits down with experts to discuss the best tips to hone and develop your communication skills, from making small talk that leaves a big impression, to keeping your nerves in check while speaking, to being more persuasive. Whether you're working on your elevator pitch or planning an important meeting, strong communication skills are important in business and life in general. That's why you'll hear from pros like neuroscientist Andrew Huberman on how to manage speaking anxiety, as well as speechwriter, best-selling author, and friend of the Fool, Dan Pink, on how to take risks in your communication, and psychologist Kelly McGonigal on how to harness nervous energy to fuel powerful presentations. All that and so much more available on the Think Fast, Talk Smart podcast. So what are you waiting for? Listen every Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.
You know, I think it becomes psychological almost. Either they don't want somebody to choose somebody as their successor who will outperform them and show them up. That certainly was the case. It seemed like that was the case with Bob Iger. And I think on some subliminal basis, it might have been the case with Jack Welch as well.
I'm Chris Hill, and that's William Cohen, a founding partner of the digital news company Puck, and author of the recently released book Power Failure: The Rise and Fall of an American Icon. Ricky Mulvey caught up with Cohen to talk about the origins of General Electric and what caused the fall of one of America's most powerful companies, key differences between former CEOs Jack Welch and Jeff Immelt, and why Cohen believes a merger between Warner Brothers Discovery and Comcast is inevitable.
So General Electric is this myth-making machine. That was one of the key things that I picked up from your book. It was born on a myth of Thomas Edison's involvement, and possibly it may be dying even on myths such as John Flannery's ouster. When you were researching General Electric and doing these interviews, I know you worked there for a couple of years. Was there any ideas that you held to be true that turned out to be myth that surprised you in the process?
No, absolutely. You know, right from the outset, in fact, you know, it was always sort of drummed into not only employees' heads, but of course, everybody's in America's head that, you know, Thomas Edison was one of the founders, you know, was the founder of GE. I mean, and if you go to the research center outside of Albany, you know, you walk into this incredibly big place and the lobby is filled with Thomas Edison sort of memorabilia. But in fact, you know, he had very little to do with the founding of the company. He was against the founding of the company and the merger that created the company. And he very quickly sold the stock that he had that resulted from the merger. And he was never an executive of the company. It was always this guy. The first executive was this guy, Charles Coffin, who was quite a remarkable businessman and a leader of the company. I mean, that's just one example.
This company then becomes one of the largest in American history, or it becomes the largest by market cap at the time in the 20th century. And one of its major problems that a lot of companies face is finding a CEO. Your book highlights sort of the pageantry involved in General Electric's succession process. Jack Welch had to participate in a letter writing contest. He had to be very, it was sort of this reality show style elimination thing where the CEO at the time, Reg Jones, is keeping all the contenders very, very close. He ends up rejecting that in looking for his CEO, maybe to his detriment in Jeff Immelt, but he still makes Jeff Immelt give a sort of the sales pitch to the board, right? So whether it's General Electric or recently at Disney, you have very smart people who know these jobs very well, and yet they seem to have so much trouble finding successors for the CEO seat. Why do you think these smart people who know the job well struggle so mightily with that process?
You know, I think it becomes psychological almost. Either they don't want somebody to choose somebody as their successor who will outperform them and show them up. That certainly was the case. It seemed like that was the case with Bob Iger. And I think on some subliminal basis, it might have been the case with Jack Welch as well. You know, choosing somebody who, on some level, you know, they thought would do a good job and certainly endorsed when they first announced the choice, but maybe on some level knew that they would not do a particularly good job and would not somehow supersede their own performance as CEO. Beyond that, I mean, you know, people are people. It's hard to know how someone is actually going to perform in the job once they have it. You know, people are very good sort of politicians sometimes, and you know, very good at sucking up to get what they want. And then when they actually get the job, they may never have been qualified for it.
I appreciate the complex picture you've given to Welch. I think a lot of his legacy has been turned into headlines of this is good or bad, when really it's a complex person who did some terrible things. He was abrasive. He was a womanizer. He also helped develop CEOs and created one of the most valuable companies in American history. He also encouraged disagreement, dissenting opinions among the people who worked for him. So why did so many of the people you spoke with, you think, actually enjoy working with Neutron Jack?
I mean, and, you know, that's an important point. All of the, to a person, all of the people who I spoke with who were senior GE executives really praised Jack and the opportunity they had to work for him. And his willingness to, you know, get the most out of them, to believe in them and to support them, and to welcome dissenting opinions, being sort of a fun guy to be around, and to really giving them huge opportunities that they wouldn't have had elsewhere. Now, obviously, I didn't talk to the people who he who felt tormented by him, or you know, they were much harder to find, and you know, they were not in the company after, you know, he sort of got rid of them. But I mean, even just taking one example of Dave Cote, who Jack fired when he was head of the major appliance business at GE, which was probably the most poorly performing business, and who went on to become the CEO, the very successful CEO of Honeywell. In fact, at one point, Honeywell's market cap was higher than GE's. And even Dave Cote, who was fired by Jack and didn't understand why, you know, praised him to the hilt. So he did engender an incredible amount of loyalty, at least among the survivors and the ones who would talk to me. Clearly, the people who he insulted or made fun of or was, you know, fired early on probably don't have a whole lot of love for him.
Yeah. Well, one of the greatest legacies was his ability to consistently hit earnings estimates that Wall Street analysts would say you're going to hit X sales, X earnings. And he hit it to a penny with great consistency. GE Capital was one of the ways, was one of the levers that he was able to pull in order to do that. Bit of a two-part question. Setting the table, what would it have meant if General Electric in the Jack Welch era missed earnings by just a penny? We came in one penny short of earnings. Because in my mind, it almost would have given the company a little bit, those numbers a little bit more legitimacy to say, nope, you guys were off by a penny. And yet it was so important to Welch at the time and many CEOs to consistently hit earnings estimates, if only by that single cent.
Yeah, I mean, part of what Jack was able to do is create a cult of Jack among Wall Street research analysts, most of whom had followed the company for a long time, knew well the industrial side of the business, but not the GE Capital or financial side of the business. And they came to rely on Jack's promise of the earnings numbers that he would project to make every quarter. You know, and along the way, as you point out, you know, I think it was like 80 straight quarters, Jack hit those numbers to the penny or a penny over, never under. And that's how GE, which had a AAA credit rating, was the most valuable company in the world for a period of time and the most respected, you know, never missed earnings. And Jack just felt like this was his religion, in effect. You know, if he told the analysts what he was going to do, he was intent on doing it. You know, he tells the story in his own book, which I asked him about and repeat the story in my book, when after he had bought Kidder Peabody, which turned out to be a disastrous acquisition, and Kidder, you know, Kidder did something in one quarter that was going to make Jack miss his numbers. He actually went to the other division heads and said, you know, can you give me something so that I can make sure that I make these earnings, that we make these earnings. And they all sort of coughed up some sort of profit number or some sort of contribution to the gap that was created by Kidder Peabody to make it possible for Jack to, you know, and GE to make the number that quarter, which was kind of prima facie evidence of earnings manipulation. And of course, he was trying to convince me the whole time that he never did that, but it was, and yet he's sort of admitting it in his own book that he pressured everybody to come up with what he needed. So he really just was, as I say, this was his religion, making those numbers every quarter. And it was very effective. When Jack took over the company, it was worth $12 billion, you know, in August of 2000, you know, 9 months before he, or 11 months or so before he left, the company was worth $650 billion. So, you know, that's quite a increase in value, and that's basically the job of the CEO is to do that kind of thing.
So to set the table a little bit, Kidder Peabody was a Wall Street investment bank that when it joined GE, there was a severe culture clash between the General Electric capital folks and the Kidder Peabody investment banking folks. So both Immelt and Welch used GE Capital, to my understanding, I could be totally wrong, is sort of a candy store to hit a lot of earnings numbers. In Immelt's case, he gave himself maybe loftier expectations, this sort of $2 earnings per share mantra. And Welch was just kind of consistently hitting those earnings numbers. So how did both of them use GE Capital as that sort of candy store to hit earnings numbers? And do you think Welch was better at the manipulation, or was Immelt unlucky?
So Jack sort of, before he became CEO, one of his final tests was to take over the running of GE Capital. You know, Jack did not have a finance background. He was an engineer, and he ran the plastics division and made the plastics division at GE incredibly commercial and incredibly profitable. But he took to GE Capital like a duck to water. He really sort of got off on this ability of to arbitrage GE's AAA credit rating, which allowed GE Capital to borrow very cheaply in the commercial paper markets and then lend out to customers and clients rather expensively. And I, you know, when I was there, I was financing leveraged buyouts, and we would get complaints all the time from customers that we were over, you know, charging more than Wall Street charged and other banks, and you know, we were so pricey. But in fact, I think really what we were doing is actually charging appropriately for the risks we were taking. But Jack really got that into a well-oiled machine. I also spent a year working for the chief credit officer at GE Capital, so I got to see all the businesses at GE Capital and, you know, how they generated an incredible amount of earnings. And And how really how clever they were under Gary Wendt to, you know, become an earnings machine. And, you know, over time, GE Capital became the most important business at GE, which most people didn't recognize or realize. You know, 40% of the earnings under Immelt, it was 50% of the earnings. Now, you know, so by the time Jack turned it over to Jeff Immelt, GE Capital was generating between 40 and 50% of GE's earnings. And it was a well-oiled machine. First under Gary Wendt and then under Dennis Naden. But, you know, Jeff Immelt was in part unlucky because, of course, he started as a CEO on his first day in the office was September 10th, 2001. And the next day, of course, was September 11th. And he was in Seattle. And, of course, the world changed. GE made the engines on those jets. Had reinsured the buildings down at the World Financial Center, owned NBC, which went without advertising for at least a week after 9/11, costing the company hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue. And of course, they, you know, there was the scandals involving big companies like Enron and WorldCom that resulted in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act being passed, which was much more stringent and required CEOs to sign off on financial statements. So, but nevertheless, throughout that, GE Capital continued to perform. And I just think that Jeff didn't understand GE Capital as well as Jack did, and didn't understand the risks as well, and didn't have the same team in place that Jack did. And so, come the 2008 financial crisis, people didn't really realize it at the time because everyone was focused on what was going on Wall Street, which was, of course, a meltdown. But GE Capital also melted down. But unlike the Wall Street banks, wasn't regulated by the Fed. And so, you know, or wasn't regulated really in the same way by the SEC as they were. And basically, Jeff Immelt had to go hat in hand to Hank Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, and Sheila Bair, the head of the FDIC, to get included in the various lines of credit that were being made available to banks so that GE Capital wouldn't be at a disadvantage to the other banks. And, you know, essentially, he just did not like the price that he had to pay for that protection and keeping GE Capital out of bankruptcy, which would have happened. And when GE Capital became a SIFI, a systemically important financial institution, Jeff Immelt hated that even more and eventually made the decision to sell GE Capital, which, you know, getting back to your $2 a share proclamation that he kept making that they were going to do in 2018. By then, he had sold off GE Capital and bought back, using the proceeds, had bought back, you know, $35 billion or so worth of GE stock at a high price and could never make that $2 a share number, even though he kept promising it over and over again. And people told him that they weren't going to make it, but he insisted that they were. And essentially, that's what cost him his job.
I want to talk about Jeff Immelt for a little bit because you have a fantastic anecdote in the story where he has this security guard named Ed Galanik, and he essentially forces the guy to climb Mount Kilimanjaro with him. And I think this is illustrative of the way he ran GE, of essentially not listening to others, even in very serious circumstances, and essentially only listening to opinions that affirmed his own. Ed Galanik was, you describe him as sort of this like tough East Coaster who had no business doing climbing a mountain. And he even says to Immelt, quote, and I'm going to paraphrase, "I think it's really unfair to kill me just to have a court jester go up a mountain." So this is to say, you spent time with Jeff Immelt. Did you get a chance to ask him about his side of the story on this, or were you focused on other, understandably focused on other things?
I was focused on many, many other things, but of course I asked him about the trip up Kilimanjaro, and he didn't want to talk about it.
Really?
So that was one thing for some reason he didn't want to talk about. Maybe because he knew, or maybe he didn't know what Ed Galanek had told me. And by the way, you know, speaking to Ed Galanek was total serendipity because it turns out that after Ed Galanek was working directly for Jeff as his, you know, head of security, he ended up, when I met him, he was working sort of at the security door at CNBC in Times Square. So when I would go and be on CNBC, you know, Ed Galanek would be the guy to let me in the door. And, you know, he eventually figured out that I was the guy writing this book about GE. And so he just, you know, kept pulling me aside and couldn't wait to tell me all these various stories that he was on the record for in the book, including this story of Kilimanjaro, which, you know, I just think is the most revealing, as you said, story about Jeff and forcing poor Ed Galanek, who had, you know, I mean, Jeff had trained, you know, because this was his daughter's graduation from college wish. You know, he said to her, you know, I've been preoccupied with GE. You know, I probably haven't been the best father. You know, and you're graduating from college. What do you want to do? I'll do anything you want. I'll go anywhere you want. And she said, I want to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. So, you know, she had trained and her friend that came with them had trained and Jeff had trained, you know, such as you can to climb a mountain, but Ed Galanek had not trained and did not want to go, and Jeff forced him to go, and literally, I think it almost killed Ed Galanek. He was very good-natured about it when he told me about it. He thought it was kind of like a lark, even though it was very dangerous for him, and he never even made it to the top because he had to turn back. And I just couldn't believe that Jeff had forced this, and of course, Jeff didn't want to talk about that because he knew what he had done. It sort of was over the bounds.
One of Immelt's most famous deals was selling NBC Universal. Immelt described it as a luxury that it could no longer afford. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that. But one of the things going on is NBC Universal was being prepared to be sold, was that they would make these random cuts to programming and content. We need to get $100 million of expenses off before the end of the year, and then we're going to reposition this production schedule to fit in better with our expense management. Now you might be seeing a similar situation at Warner Brothers Discovery, where it's the company is slashing and burning content. You have some of the similar players of David Zaslav running Warner Brothers Discovery. Is your studying of the history of NBC Universal influence your viewpoint that perhaps Warner Brothers Discovery may be prepared for getting sold or combined into another company?
Well, I've been writing at Puck regularly about my sense that NBC Universal, which is now owned by Comcast, and Warner Brothers Discovery, which is, of course, run by David Zaslav and a public company, that they're both sort of, they kind of need each other, and they're both undersized compared to Disney and, you know, the threats posed to their business model by Amazon and Apple, which obviously are much larger capitalized companies, much bigger. And so I've been sort of advocating, you know, for the last, 6 months or so, the inevitable combination between NBC Universal and Warner Brothers Discovery. Of course, you know, the people at those companies, you know, poo-poo it at the moment because, of course, they have to because of the rules that allowed Warner Brothers, Discovery to be formed in the first place under the reverse Morris Trust rules. And under those rules, you know, there can't be a change of ownership or a change of structure for 2 years. So that would put it at April 2024. There's no question that they need each other. And I suspect at some point soon, those discussions will begin if they haven't started already, even though there won't be any announcement for some time. It takes a long time to figure out the structure of that kind of complicated combination and as well as any regulatory approval. would take a very long time too. So I suspect that it'll happen. You know, David Zaslav is really a pioneer in cable business, and has, I think, you know, done a good job leading Discovery. He probably got snookered a little bit by the AT&T folks, who loaded up Warner Brothers Discovery with $55 billion of debt, which was sort of the price of admission for David Zaslav to get control of the old Time Warner. And then now he's got to sort of live with that burden. So I think that's why he's cutting and burning, slashing and burning as best he can to make sure that the EBITDA for Warner Brothers Discovery is what he's telling the street it is. You know, the good news is that after a pretty bad 2022, where the stock fell something like 60%, it's sort of off to the races so far this year. It was up like 18% last time I checked. But I think the combination of the two is pretty much inevitable, even though I may be among only a handful of people who believe that at the moment.
Well, what makes it, corporations don't necessarily have to merge. They can exist and live and die on their own. What makes it inevitable?
Well, what I think makes it inevitable is just the competitive landscape and the ambitions of the people involved. You know, Brian Roberts has always been, you know, ambitious for Comcast to make it, you know, as big as it is, a $200 billion market value company. But I think, you know, he clearly got NBC Universal at a bargain price from GE. Jeff Immelt sold it without an auction, soon after the financial crisis in 2009. At one point pre-pandemic, that business was probably worth about $100 billion. The pandemic has been kind of rough on linear TV. And so those numbers are down. I'm sure Brian Roberts is smart enough to know that NBC Universal is, no longer a size where it can compete effectively against Disney or Apple or Amazon. The streaming business, is costing him a lot of money. And also, you know, Warner Brothers Discovery is sort of subsized and has a lot of great assets, but too much debt, as we were talking about, struggling kind of on the EBITDA line. And it's got its own costs related to the streaming business. So combining the two would make for a major league competitor to Disney and Apple and Amazon, and would help spread out that debt over more assets and more cash flow. And so it might mean that, of course, Comcast has to control 51% of it, because I think Brian Roberts would want to have at least ownership control, as he did during the first phase of the NBC Universal deal. But I think it's a deal that could get done that would allow David Zaslav to run the combined company, which is, I think, his goal. So I think there's a way to make it all worthwhile and make a major league competitor to Disney.
I appreciate your perspective on that. And as we get towards the end of the conversation, going to turn it back to General Electric. You've described your book as a corporate autopsy. Do you have a time of death? There's plenty of finger pointing reasons, and those can be found in the pages, but do you have a time of death for your corporate autopsy of General Electric?
You know, I think that, there were a number of important moments where the death spiral began. Among them, the decision to sell NBCU in 2009 without an auction for a total of around $30 billion to Comcast. That was number one. Number two was the decision to buy Alstom and wildly overpay for it, when actually Jeff probably could have gotten out of the deal and chose not to, and chose to close the deal. That was number two. Number three was the decision to sell GE Capital and you know, make an announcement that you were doing that, so buyers knew that you had to sell it, probably got his pocket picked by some smart buyers like Blackstone and Wells Fargo. And number four was bringing in Nelson Peltz at Tryon Partners to as a hedge fund, an activist hedge fund. Jeff's idea was he was going to sort of ratify his brilliant recreation of the company. Of course, with Nelson Peltz, there's no such bargain. When it was clear that he wasn't going to achieve this $2 a share, that was the end of Jeff and, frankly, the end of the company because, you know, as John Flannery, who took over from Jeff Immelt, quickly discovered there were, you know, hidden time bombs that Jeff had not really addressed, shall we say, that Jeff, John Flannery had to address and announce. So I don't know, the time of the death was probably when Jeff Immelt got fired in June of 2000, 17, I guess. So that was probably, you know, the end of it, even though it took, a few more years for the plug to finally get pulled. It was basically in hospice from June 2017 on.
William Cohen, he's the author of Power Failure, The Rise and Fall of an American Icon, founder of Puck as well. Thank you so much for joining us on Motley Fool Money. I appreciate your time and recommend the book. It's a thorough and engaging history of one of the most powerful icons of American history.
Thank you very much for having me.
As always, people on the program may have interest in the stocks they talk about, and the Motley Fool may have formal recommendations for or against, so don't buy or sell stocks based solely on what you hear. I'm Chris Hill. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.